Hello and welcome to the Paper Club Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Rafael Herrera, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Marcia Olivaida, lead data scientist at Deeper Insights. How are you, Marcia?
I'm fine. Hi, everyone.
Every month, we do invite a Deeper Insights expert to the show to highlight and discuss an academic paper from the data science literature. And this month's guest is a repeat guest. She's been here before, and this is Dr. Caterina Calvado, a senior data scientist specializing in computer vision. I hope I said that name right.
Yes, you did a very good job.
Fantastic. Caterina, tell us, what paper did you bring us this month?
Hi, good morning, everybody, or good afternoon. It depends, of course. So the paper of this month is called High-Resolution Image Reconstruction with Latent Diffusion Models for Human Brain Activity. I know, interesting, right? So the authors are Takagi and Nishimoto, and they are coming from Osaka University in Japan.
This is a special kind of podcast because both my co-host and our guest are super excited about this one, and Marcia really wanted to jump in on this. So Marcia, give us a quick breakdown of what this paper is all about.
Yeah, sure. So this paper proposes basically a novel visual reconstruction method using latent diffusion models. And they show that their method can reconstruct high-resolution images with isometric fidelity from the human brain activity as obtained from fMRI. And unlike previous studies of image reconstruction, their method, which is kind of a big thing, does not require any training or fine-tuning of complex deep learning models. It only requires simple linear mappings from fMRI to latent representations within latent diffusion models. More particularly stable diffusion. That's the model they're using. Yeah, that kind of sums up the paper, really. And I think that's the part that it doesn't require any training or fine-tuning, unlike previous, it makes a big difference. Definitely, the retraining part is a very big one. And the paper also introduces a different concept. So people, researchers, have been exploring the use of convolutional neural networks for making sense of how the brain is working and how these visual reconstructions, so which type of operation or function happens at the different layers of these convolutional neural networks. Unlike that, in this paper, and as Marcia mentioned, they are exploring latent diffusion models, which have lots of advantages. They are on a much compressed scale. They are easier in this case. They do not need training. So they are exploring latent diffusion models, unlike CNN, for this reconstruction and understanding the brain function. Apart from that, they are also, of course, latent stable diffusion. It's also essential for generative AI, and that's also a very hot topic. And so all about this paper is very interesting. All visual representations, understanding brains, neuroscience, and generative AI together in this great paper.
So to break it down in a very simple way, a way that I can understand, we're essentially being able to look inside the brain and produce images from the brain. Would that be an accurate assessment?
We are looking at images that show us which part of the brain is being activated when seeing, for instance, a picture of a dog or a picture of a cat or like a picture of sunset. So when those images are shown to patients or to people, in this case, to volunteers, different parts of the brain are activated. And we get those activation maps, if you want can say that, put it into this neural network and understand, we are able to get what the person is thinking and representing on its mind into an actual picture that we can then compare against the one that was shown. So it's understanding the representation system that the person is exploring in their brain to analyze the image that is being shown.
Almost mind reading, but not quite.
Not yet.
Not yet. Yes, that's the key word, isn't it?
Yes. It still needs a stimuli. They are shown a picture or several pictures, right, in the session. And then we compare, and this will be the ground truth, and then we reconstruct the image based on the fMRI, like the brain activity, and then compare the reconstructed image with the ground truth. I wonder, like, there are several subjects being basically tested, right? And how subjective and how similar or different are the representations from the brain, because people also, although we share a common understanding of the world, I think there are individual differences. So I would be interested to know a little bit more about that.
Yes, that's exactly true, Marcia. The paper shows several interesting examples where, for instance, there's this airplane, the person is shown a picture of an airplane, and then we get the outcomes of the person's understanding on that picture. And even though we see on the four subjects, so this study is exploring the use of fMRI and latent diffusion models on four subjects. So even though the four representations of the same picture are different, they still resemble like an airplane. This empowers that understanding that we have that one picture can represent many things for different persons. So like the blue can be different for many people. There's always this type of interpretation. What we see is not actually what our brain understands.
Right. And that sounds a little bit like you're mapping brain networks. Is that pretty much what you're doing with seeing what's swelling up with blood? Is that what's happening here? Or how is the fMRI actually interpreting this data?
Yes, the fMRI, so the technical or the physical aspect of that imaging modality, it's based on emitting a lot of magnetic fields into the brain and then measuring how the protons align with those magnetic fields. And when the person is actively doing something, in this case, cognitive, looking at the picture and understanding how that picture, so different parts of the brain have different type of activations, let's say. That's also when how people understand. So we have like the visual cortex, we know that the left side does something, the right side does something else. So that's how fMRI, it's what is guiding knowledge into understanding which portions of the brain are being used when doing specific tasks or when activating specific regions.
So I wonder, to be more kind of jump into the technicalities, how were they able to not rely on any training or fine-tuning and just use the fMRI as input to the latent diffusion model? Because it usually requires some kind of image or text conditioning at the beginning, right? But we're not providing any of that, are we, Katarina? What's kind of the approach that they're taking?
In the paper, they look at two different areas of the visual cortex. They look at the early layers of the visual cortex, which in the literature has been reported to perceive contours, edges, basic geometrical information. So that's the early visual cortex layers. And then they are also looking at the late ventral layers where that information, such as the shapes and the basic information that it's understood on the early layers, is combined with texture, with color. So the late stages in that ventral path combine the information, the different types of information from more basic to more complex. And so we get this understanding of depth, we get the understanding of color and shape on the combining all of those. So in this approach, they use linear regression layers to convert, let's say in an easy way, convert from the basic visual features into an embedded space that then is fed into, let's do a bit of rewind on the diffusion and the stable diffusion process. So then it's fed into the diffusion process, which is applying noise to that embedded space. And then there's a UNet that does the denoising of that. So by introducing noise, then we try to learn to remove the noise. And that's how the generative process happens with the stable diffusion. So input is the stimuli or the fMRI representation of the stimuli on the early visual layers. And then the conditioning that happens, characteristic of stable diffusion, happens by also using another linear regressor on these late visual stages. And that's conditioned to the denoising process. And that, as the paper shows, it brings a lot of advantage when reconstructing the images. For instance, one of those examples, so the ground truth is a clock tower. The output of this compression first stage before introducing noise looks like a sheep with glasses, nothing against. And then when going through the diffusion and the denoising and conditioned by the ventral activation, we can see that that sheep is actually converted or generates an actual clock tower. So the conditioning part here, it's very relevant, and the results show that conditioning is very important for the final reconstruction to resemble like the ground truth.
Yeah, that's one of the main takeaways from the paper, that kind of this conditioning, again, using the fMRI, but a different part of the brain, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of this more complex, the one that is related with more complex features, Katrin mentioned. This conditioning during the denoising process, using the fMRI, but a different part of the brain, a different region of the brain that's related with more complex features, is crucial to get high resolution reconstructed images with high semantic fidelity. Because if we use just the autoencoder representation, it's a bit fuzzy, it's not very clear. Also, just the conditioner embedding, it's also not very clear because it's more focused on the texture and the colors, as Katrina mentioned. But if we combine both, usually it produces very good results, very close to the ground truth. Is that correct, Katrina?
Yes, that's exactly it. So the conditioning is key element here. And we keep saying ground truth, and then we keep saying reconstructed images. So how did they actually measure this? Some important factors. So they, it is a bit trendy today to include subjectivity in the analysis of these results. And I agree, and I see why, and I believe we all see why and agree that it's valuable. So in this paper, they combined quantitative approaches that look at perceptual similarity loss. So they measure the difference between reconstructed and ground truth. But they also ask six people, to look at the ground truth and the reconstructed images and assess how similar they were. So they explore quantitative and subjective analysis on the assessment of this reconstruction quality.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, so everyone just laid there and looked at the same image, and then we looked at what these six different people saw, essentially.
Yes, it was a bit more painful than that, I think, Raf. So session took 30 to 40 minutes, and they repeated it 5 times, I think, if I'm not wrong, and they looked at 10,000 images. So yes, there was a lot of looking around.
Wow. And I bet it wasn't like fun images. It was just like, and here's a train, and here's
it
a bird.
It is Coco. Yeah, that's a very technical question. Thank you for asking.
Yes, of course.
The authors used the Coco dataset, which is very common. It is typically used for object detection. Everybody in the field knows it. Maybe the subjects not. So, but the type of pictures is like very concrete objects. So a car, an airplane, someone skiing down the hill, the sea. So there's a wide range of classes, but it's not very busy. Typically, it's not a very busy data set. So if there's like a clock tower, then it's going to be isolated potentially in a blue sky, which makes it easier for understanding how similar they are or not, or for the person to be able to reconstruct it in its mind.
Simple photos, trying to get simple results and start from there. A nice baseline, a foundation to develop further on this research. That sounds fascinating. It seems like there's a lot that we could do with something like this. So for each of these episodes, I always want to know, how do you think this is going to impact your work? I mean, what are you going to do? But really, that kind of ties into the main thing that we are the most excited about in this paper is the applications of this kind of research. Now, obviously, we are far away from this being a thing. But when do you think... actually, two questions. When do you think we're actually going to get somewhere where we might be able to use this as a headset or something you put in your ear or even chip you put in your brain or whatever it is they decide to do? How far away do you think we are from something like this? And what is that something like this when we finally get it? What do you think?
So first question is, how does it impact our lives at work. This is a very specific neuroscience application. I would love to be able to work with this technology on this type of field, of course. But I think there's like a lot of clinical value that, apart from all the cool applications that we'll talk afterwards, but there's a lot of clinical value understanding which regions of the brain are being used for X or Y, and there's planning, for instance, surgery, potentially understanding when there's a problem in the brain, how does it affect. So there's all these clinical applications. In essence, the technological foundation that the paper shows is generative AI. And as you know, here at Deeper Insights, we are like going full on generative AI. So the tech, not the field is a bit more complex to get into, but the technology is something that we are exploring constantly to increase data set sizes, generate high, good quality training data. So generative AI in computer vision has a very wide range of possibilities. With respect to application, I'll just say like one, the first that popped up into my mind when I was reading the paper, and that was capacity, the ability to understand what our pets think of us. Like,
if we want to know.
You don't know. You never know what they think about us, how they feel, if they are hurt. It's like, where does it hurt? They don't talk. But this would be a way of like getting this communication happening in between species. And so that was the first application that I saw on BitOnMore, the fun side of the spectrum.
That would be so useful to understand what my baby is thinking and what are his needs, really.
I think anyone that's encountered a baby is going to want to know what they're thinking. Absolutely. I mean, it's a little bit like, is this kid hungry? Do they want to, you know, do they like this car ride that we're going on? When are they going to start getting fussy? And you can build a whole industry on that. I mean, I think there was a Simpsons episode about something like that. So there's
if
a lot.
If it was on Simpsons, then it will happen.
Oh, yeah, pretty much.
Continue on the applications. This reminds me of a Black Mirror episode, The Entire is to Review. They have like this grain technology, this implant that they put in, I think, in their ear. And they were able to record everything they hear and see and do, and then kind of project that into an external device or even internally replay that. So basically making a movie out of your life and being able to see that
as a movie.
I kind of imagine these like being able to see movies of our dreams. That would be, I think, very fascinating. Also to shed some light into the what dreams mean and what's this process all about, because that's one of the mysteries, really. Why do we dream? And
I don't know how much it will answer why we dream, but it will definitely show us the strange thoughts that we are having when we are sleeping, which, you know, honestly, I don't know if we want to see some of that stuff. I mean, it really is like, oh my God, I think that's how I really feel about that. And then that still opens it up for interpretation, because that's all it is. All this is interpretation. And then after you interpret something, you associate whatever emotions to it that you wish, right? So you see it and it's either good or it's bad, or maybe you want to reevaluate how you want to live your life just by looking at your dreams. Who knows?
Yeah, I would definitely. I have very scary dreams all the time. They are very violent. So first, I would not want to revive my dreams because they are very intense. And then secondly, I'm sure there would be someone saying that, Catherine, that's not normal.
We keep them secret, well, hopefully. So,
yeah.
But I think especially with you, you're talking about a lot of violent dreams and things like that. But most of your work had to do with a lot of dead people. So
Yes, that's a very fun fact. I never dreamt about of any of those corpses that we used to work with, which is very strange, right? Yeah, our brain works in a very unknown way.
The thing about that is becoming more and more known, and that's the scary part. And now we'll even be able to see inside in some weird way. Now, I did mention we are a little bit further away from this. This is just the very beginning stages of this kind of technology. And it seems like there's actually been a fair amount of research done on this. Marcia, you've come across a couple of other examples, not just stable diffusion.
Yeah, the first early attempts, based on my research, as far as I know, go back to 2011, like some research made in USA in the University of California in Berkeley. And also there's some research from, for instance, Meta AI that tries to convert also brain activity into a continuous stream of text. Also, like very recent as well, MindHigh, which is similar to the research presented in the paper, but I can't recall the details. But there's plenty being done. And also another one, which is kind of creating like mind video, which kind of creates cinematic mindscapes, create high quality video reconstruction from brain activity. Instead of just reconstructing images, goes forward and reconstructs videos.
My understanding of that one, it's a group out of Hong Kong, I believe, that are doing essentially the same kind of research, but with video. So they are showing a stimuli and then the brain is interpreting it. Again, similar, if not exactly the same as what we've been talking about today, but moving images, actual, like, I believe they showed one of somebody looking at a fish and then they reconstructed vague ideas or shapes that might resemble the movement of a fish, which is really fascinating because we are that much closer. One application or one thing that this always reminds me of, and I don't know why it's been on my mind a lot, is RoboCop. And I know this is a bit of a stretch for some of you that may not know RoboCop the way I do, but think about it this way. RoboCop was a person that had to have a neural interlink to interpret the world in a computer kind of way. So if we have a chip that we put in our brains and we have to use a visor or have our eyes be a computer equipment, essentially, this is one step to that. So it is the gap between a computer brain and a regular brain and working together to interpret the world. And there's something very neat about the fact that I could be RoboCop one day. I like that. So
I'd like to see that, John.
Yeah, why not?
You asked about how long would it take?
Yeah, I'm curious.
My wild guess, and assuming the research has started in 2011, so that we will actually start seeing some things, some type of gaming, some type of recording, like efficiency tricks. Why do you have to think and write if you can just like think or think right at the same time? So I would guess 5 years.
5 years, really? Wow.
Okay. I had the same number in mind. That's very curious. I wonder if we did some mind reading here. Maybe. But this is just an MVP, so just like this basic, you know, the first Alexa, or not ChatGPT, because when it came out, it was very good already. But so this very basic application that, oh, let's try this. I'm in the car and I want to take notes instead of talking, because it's also less efficient. There's always like thinking and acting. Let's take notes. And then I think, and somehow, I don't know what, how yet, but you can get this type transfer of thing.
I think you're right when it comes to the first application being something as simple as writing, because yes, we can do the neural interlink, which, oh, by the way, Elon Musk has Neuralink, who just got FDA approval to start, you know, testing this on humans. So we are literally steps away from that. I remember some research from within the last 5 years or so where they were able to interpret what somebody was trying to say just by putting a mechanism on your throat. It doesn't even require the brain, but whenever we write, it seems like we are saying, quote unquote, saying these words in our throat. So we don't even need the brain necessarily. So I'm not sure if I'm remembering that correctly, because again, memories are reconstructions of thoughts from before. So who knows? But I do remember that it was a very neat trick that if you could get something on your throat, you could essentially do what you were describing without having to go in through the brain.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. But if we can do more than one way, it might be more accurate. So who knows?
Yeah. MRI is like a gold standard, but you can get readings from the brain activity using different type of, well, using sensors. So that would be, yes, I would not be taking notes in my car inside an fMRI at the same time.
It would be very
That would make it a bit impractical.
You would need a big car. I mean, really,
that's going nowhere.
Yeah.
So, if we think about it from like this electrodes perspective, that would not be that, well, they're not invasive. Then we have like crossed the boundary of like accessibility. And so, yes, I'm looking forward to it. Of course, as with every AI and ethics issues that we are like thinking about,
right,
there's this open room for all the good things and many, many bad things. So we have always to await this, but I'm looking forward to that moment.
There's a lot, also a very important application in healthcare, of course, a very obvious one, that those people that kind of lose their ability to communicate, or they are in kind of in a more vegetative state, so like in coma, they have been through traumatic brain injuries, and they lose their ability to communicate. I think these kind of techniques can help like communicate with these people as well. I think that can be very valuable.
Just as long as the parts that are needed for interpretation haven't been damaged.
Yeah.
I think there is absolutely potential.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, if I'm in a coma because my brain got turned to jelly, I probably won't be able to interface with a machine, but we can hope. I absolutely hope that would be an excellent application because, yeah, we would love to know what these people would want us to do with them.
Even do reverse engineering on it. So someone that cannot see, we can actually introduce those stimuli the other way around. So instead of like measuring what the brain does and constructing a picture, then just like we know that to reconstruct picture of a dog, these, that, and the other portions of the brain will have to be activated. So that's a bit longer in time.
That's very interesting.
But it's like almost like the reverse process.
I think that's actually a great place to end it, because looking even further down the line, there could be even more applications and more creative ways of using this technology. But I think the paper that the two of you have brought to the podcast have definitely showcased that there is a foundation for some really big things coming down the line. And all thanks to generative AI as well. So who would have thought? It's not just for making fun pictures. So with that, I want to thank my co-host, Marcia, for coming along. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. And I also want to thank Catarina Carvalho for joining us again and for bringing such an interesting topic and paper for the very exciting ideas for applications. Thank you, Catarina.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You're always welcome back on the show. I know this is your second time here and can't wait for the third one because, you know what, these papers keep getting more and more interesting. It's always great to have you around. Thank you for joining us. And I also wanted to thank our delightful listeners for listening in. And if you like discussing data science, academic papers, anything like that, please subscribe to the feed. We hope to release these every month as we have so far and would love to have you along for the ride. So if you have questions about this particular episode or episodes that we've done in the past, please send them our way as well at thepaperclub@deeperinsights.com. And until next month, I am Rafael Herrera. We've got Marcia with us, and we have Catarina. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.